Friday, August 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Joe Biden closes out the final night of the Democratic National Convention with a message of hope.
And this really is the biggest chance that Biden has to show himself to the American people, what his values are, his history of public service, as well as defining himself in contrast to Donald Trump.
Russia's opposition leader hospitalized in grave condition from a suspected poisoning.
Doctors have put him into a coma and connected to a respirator.
Also ahead, Black Ambition, the message of a brand new release by two influential musical artists. It's all on today's International Edition. Joe Biden officially accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday night in a moment that marks the climax of his party's unorthodox 2020 national convention. The former vice president, who at 77 years old would be the oldest president ever elected, becomes the Democrats' official standard bearer for the campaign against President Donald Trump in November. The focus has been on uniting the deeply divided nation as Americans grapple with a health crisis, economic devastation, and a national awakening on racial justice. Joining us to talk about the final night of the convention is VOA White House reporter Patsy Wiedekuswara in Wilmington, Delaware, where Biden gave his speech. Thank you so much, Patsy. Tell us about what you have been seeing and hearing on the ground there.
So, Lori, I've been covering conventions since 2004, and this is certainly by far the most unconventional convention. As we know, this is almost 100% exclusively virtual, except for the speeches that was delivered by Joe Biden as well as Kamala Harris last night. Outside of the venue, we saw a whole parking lot full of cars, people watching the speech on a jumbotron screen. People were not allowed to step outside of the cars. So they were being very careful in terms of social distancing and keeping everybody safe. In the afternoon, about 4 or 5 hours right before the speech, I saw about 200 people, Trump supporters, protesting Joe Biden. And this made for some interesting interaction between the Trump supporters and the Joe Biden supporters. A lot of arguments, a lot of whataboutisms, but thankfully everything was peaceful and the police also kept everybody safe.
You mentioned, you know, all this, you know, the social distancing and such an unconventional convention. It sounds like reporters in general and, of course, you covering this really had to go through a lot just to be able to be there to cover it.
Right. So it's been very limited for the media, right? I mean, media, yes, of course, they can come. They can do their stand-ups at the media perimeter outside. But if we're going to go inside the Chase Center where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris delivered their speech, first of all, there's only a handful of reporters. There's less than 3 dozen reporters, including myself, who was able to get in. And we had to be tested. We were tested from 2 days beforehand, every morning, as well as the evening before we went in, another test. They had a health app that made us download, and you know, we had to fill in all these questionnaires to make sure that we're following health protocols, really, really being very careful. Everybody was handed out N95 masks. Social distancing was practiced. So they really want to be careful and make sure that there's not a, you know, news piece 2 weeks from now saying that there's a whole lot of transmissions, COVID transmissions that happened during the convention.
What was the overall message of Biden's big speech and the theme from Democrats? Of course, many who spoke before he did that were his former rivals singing right. His praises.
Yeah, so the overall theme of Thursday night is America's promise, right? Which is meant to convey Joe Biden's character, experience, as well as his vision of America in terms of what kind of policies that he's going to lay out. So the evening showcased Biden's past not only as a former vice president, but also a longtime legislator and public defender, you know, just his whole many decades of public service. And this really is the biggest chance that Biden has to show himself to the American people, what his values are, his history of public service, as well as defining himself in contrast to Donald Trump, which I'm sure at this point, almost everybody has already understood where they differ in terms of all the different policies. And as we know that this is not Joe Biden's first rodeo, he has tried to aim for the presidency numerous times, beginning in his first campaign in 1987, where he presented himself at that time as the next generation. Well, that dream did not come about until now, more than 30 years later, tonight in his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware, in a manner which is very strange, very bizarre, and again, not a conventional convention, and perhaps not the kind of convention that he has been dreaming or planning for.
Right, but certainly with all those people that he ran against speaking on his behalf, certainly seemed like that message of unity was loud and clear.
Right, and that was another thing that the Democrats really wanted to convey, was a message of ideological unity. Everyone from the progressive wings of the party, the Bernie Sanders and AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, if you like, as well as the ones all the way to Republicans. We see during this convention a number of Republicans speaking up for Joe Biden and against Donald Trump. And even today, we heard that more than 70 senior Republican officials, many of them held important positions during the Bush administrations and other Republican administration, flatly coming out and saying that Donald Trump is dangerous, and that's why we're voting for Joe Biden.
And Patsy, lastly, President Trump was not that far away, a couple of states over, earlier in the day before Joe Biden's speech, with his own rally of sorts.
Yes, and this is certainly something very interesting and something that has not really happened in American politics before. I mean, traditionally, when one party has a convention, the other party kind of stays quiet and lays low and gives the other party a chance to be in the spotlight, but this is not happening this year with President Trump going to a campaign rally in Pennsylvania in a town not far from where Biden was born, where he accused Biden of having abandoned the state, even though we know that Biden was a child when his family moved from Pennsylvania to Delaware. And Donald Trump also predicted mayhem if Joe Biden wins the election in November, really bashing him on a number of issues from trade, immigration, to Biden wanting to defund the police, a claim that Joe Biden has denied. So the president said that at stake of this election is the survival of our nation, because we're dealing with crazy people on the other side. They've gone totally stone cold crazy. That was what he said. And so this also gives us a taste of what is to come next week at the Republican National Convention, when President Trump will have the whole 4 days for himself to express his vision for the country.
VOA White House reporter Patsy Wiedekuswara in Wilmington, Delaware. Former Trump administration chief strategist Steve Bannon was arrested and indicted on Thursday, facing allegations in a southern border wall scheme. AP Washington correspondent Sadra Magani reports.
Prosecutors say Bannon and three associates ripped off donors who contributed more than $25 million to build part of the wall. The criminal charges say much of the money never made it to the wall, instead enriching the men, including Bannon, who was pulled from a luxury yacht off the Connecticut coast. He's the latest in a long line of Trump associates who've been prosecuted, though the president was quick to distance himself from his former aide and the scheme.
I know nothing about the project other than I didn't like when I read about it. I didn't like it. I said, this is for government. This isn't for private people. And it sounded to me like showboating.
The president did tell reporters he feels very badly about the situation. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny is in a coma and on a ventilator in a hospital intensive care unit in Siberia after falling ill from suspected poisoning during a flight. Charles Maines in Moscow updates International Edition's Steve Miller.
Well, so Alexei Navalny, he's the Russian opposition leader. He was on a tour in Siberia. He was on his way home on a flight from the city of Tomsk in Siberia to Moscow. When he fell ill aboard the flight, he actually collapsed inside the laboratory. We have a witness video from the plane where you can hear Mr. Navalny screaming in pain from the laboratory. The plane then made an emergency landing in the city of Omsk, where he's now in hospital. Doctors have put him into an induced coma and connected him to a respirator. His spokeswoman, Kira Yarmish, says that it was a deliberate poisoning. Mr. Navalny had had some tea in the morning. In fact, there's pictures of him sitting in the airport having his tea. And of course, from the airlines, we've also heard that they served him no food or drink while he was aboard the flight. So that's their theory for now.
Has there been any official response from the Russian government about the accusation?
No official response from the Russian government yet. I suspect we may hear some comment from the Kremlin spokesman when he gives his sort of daily talk with journalists here in Moscow. We know that there are plenty of police on the scene, presumably to do an investigation. We have also heard from the deputy head doctor of the hospital. who said that Navalny's condition had stabilized but was still serious. He said that doctors weren't simply doing everything possible. They were trying to save his life, working to save his life.
Have the physicians or the hospital commented on the allegation of poisoning?
They have not. And we've gotten some conflicting signs from that. He was checked in under suspicion of poisoning, but the presence of police, at least according to Mr. Navalny's associates, they think that that's led them to kind of squash that theory, at least initially, until some kind of messaging can come out in terms of a theory of what's behind this. But we have to acknowledge the reality of a kind of a grim history of poisoning of government opponents in Russia.
There was also the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Britain.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's a pattern here, and part of the debate that centers in Moscow and is whether this is the doing of the government or if it's independent actors.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel was in France Thursday for a pre-planned visit with French President Emmanuel Macron, where they were expected to talk about Belarus and Mali. But the situation with Alexei Navalny, the most prominent member of Russia's opposition, took on an even bigger sense of concern during the conversation. Joining us now for details on what the two leaders said is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, tell us about the conversation.
It was very obvious when Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel switched to talking about the subject of Navalny that they were very concerned. You felt their body language change considerably, and the tone and just their forcefulness changed. President Macron said that he was very disturbed. He was shocked by what had happened. He said that he wanted everything possible to be done for this man who's become known here really as a critic of the Kremlin. And he even went so far, President Macron, as to say that France would help this man whether he wanted asylum, whether he wanted protection, or whether he just wanted medical help, that France stands ready to provide that for him and also for his family. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, said as well that she said if asked, they would be happy to provide medical assistance. That would mean German hospitals. But she said that the request has to come from Russia, although she didn't actually say who that request would come from. So initially, it was really is just shock that it's come to such a point.
And Catherine, there's been a lot of talk about planes specifically coming from Berlin. Why that particular place and location?
This is a private initiative in Berlin that says it is able to facilitate a transfer for Navalny to Berlin. Now, the background to that is that a particular hospital in Berlin, the Charité Hospital, has a special poisons unit. It is used to dealing with poisons and people suffering from poisons, not just in Germany. We think back 2 years ago, the husband of one of the members of Pussy Riot, the protest punk band in Russia, he was treated at that particular hospital for alleged poisoning. So there is really a trend we've been seeing over the years of Berlin being a place where not just Russian political exiles go, but also you see a lot of Russian oligarchs in Berlin as well. So in lots of ways, it does make sense that when it came to actually having an initiative up and ready, that it was this group of Berlin individuals, but also organized, who were ready to go and do what they can to help this man, whether it be just to help him in terms of health, asylum, or just protection.
It sounds like the Russian hospital where Navalny was initially rushed to from the emergency landing off that plane may not really have the capability to be able to treat him for something like this.
It is a hospital sort of halfway between Siberia and Moscow. It's not as what you would expect at the sort of hospital you would get in Moscow, but certainly all the talk is about, and certainly from his own entourage, the hope of getting him him to a hospital like the Charité Hospital in Berlin, where he would have the top treatment.
And did Merkel and Macron have a chance to talk about some of the other issues that they had initially been planning on, such as Mali or Belarus?
They did. And this is really a sort of a summer get-together. The end of summer, Emmanuel Macron, French president, always has one other leader come and stay at his residence overnight. They have dinner. The main point that Emmanuel Macron made was he said he'd invited Angela Merkel because he believes that Europe needs to stand united, it needs to be independent, it needs to be sovereign, and it needs to appeal for the world to act in a multilateral way. So he did also say this is a world where everything is being shuffled around. There's a lot happening. In particular, when he mentioned Mali, both Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron mentioned Mali. They said that they would like to see a return to democracy. They would like to see any unlawful power grab be stopped, be changed. What was interesting when they talked about Mali was that the French president talked about a European aspect when it comes to Mali. So you could see him moving away from France being the predominant partner, even though France does have 5,000 troops in the Sahel and is actually more of a force there. But the fact that also Angela Merkel was talking about how much civilian assistance they're giving. So, you know, they were saying that this is something that Europe does worry about. When it comes to Belarus, Angela Merkel was very confused. She said that they have been trying to find some way of getting a dialogue going between protesters and between the current regime, but she said nothing seems to be happening. And for her to say that is very important because Angela Merkel is one of the few European leaders who speaks regularly to Vladimir Putin. She speaks to him in Russian. She's been talking to him for a long time, knows him. But it would seem from her hints and her body language that Vladimir Putin isn't interested in having some sort of three-way dialogue between the Belarusians, someone in Europe, and himself.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Fields. Mali's opposition coalition Thursday dismissed efforts by regional powers to block a coup-driven change of government, saying it would work with the junta that ousted the president to restore stability to the country. The Economic Community of West African States, which was convening over the crisis, suspended Mali, shut borders, and halted financial flows in response to Tuesday's overthrow of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. A leading member of the Malian opposition coalition, M5R, FP says citizens are looking forward to a yet-to-be-established transitional government, which will organize fresh elections next year. Yes, Samake tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the military junta will have the support of the people if the leaders keep to their promise to peacefully hand over power following an election next year.
The junta people have given some assurances that elections will be organized in 2021, in 9 months. That this gives an assurance that they're not here to remain in power. And they're going to also organize the transition in such a way that there will be only 6 members of a military among the 24 members that they're planning to have the transition team. And then we'll be forming a unity government. We are beginning to understand that they are working with the people and they're working with opposition and all the political, because I have been clear that power does not belong to the military. They should be under political authority, and they are not suited in democracy to rule. So as long as that is the perspective and the vision that they will take, they will have the accompaniment of the people of Mali for sure.
Some people are saying that the military coup is a violation of the very constitution that Malians embraced.
Absolutely. We have expressed our condemnation. This is an unprescribable crime in Mali, according to our constitution. But the international community, including France, if you've heard the statement from Emmanuel Macron, that we cannot dwell on the condemnation. We have to move on to how do we move forward? How do we take this country forward? That is today. The main concerns of the Mali people, including the political authorities.
So what are the aspirations of the people of Mali, for which the opposition said they represent, going forward following this coup?
Our aspiration is that we are never going to go back to business as usual, where leaders are not accountable to the people. And that's the reason why there has been protests in Mali throughout the country to combat ill governance. So I think that this is a turning point from corruption, from ill governance to a more efficient leadership. That's what the people of Mali aspire for. And that is what we will be requiring of our leadership. There is never going to be business as usual in Mali again. So this is a turning point.
Yeah, what do you say to regional leaders in ECOWAS and the African Union? These two organizations have a zero tolerance for military coup. As an opposition leader in Mali, what is your take on the condemnation and the suspicion that perhaps even the junta might not even organize the election within the period they promised to?
The junta is going to be kept into contempt the same way we have kept the outing president in contempt. We are not going to see. The people of Mali are going to remain mobilized and vigilant and making sure that the power belongs to the people and that power is for the well-being and the welfare of the people of Mali. So that is our intent.
Yay Samake, speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. At least 45 African migrants and refugees have perished in the Mediterranean Sea in the largest recorded shipwreck off the Libyan coast this year. Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul.
Survivors said the ship's engine exploded off the coast of Libya, drowning more than half of the people on the crowded boat, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. The victims were mostly from Senegal, Mali, Chad, and Ghana, and they are among more than 300 people who have died this year trying to get to Europe from Libya by sea. Officials say that estimate is probably very low. This is Tariq Argaz from the UNHCR in Libya.
Local fishermen were the ones that spotted the boat and rescued the 37 survivors. And these survivors were the ones that gave us the details on the date of departure and the number of people that unfortunately lost their lives.
Europe no longer sends rescue ships to sea to search for people attempting to cross in small, often barely floating boats, leaving the Libyan Coast Guard as the only hope for victims of shipwrecks. The travelers on these boats are almost always people who have fled violence or extreme poverty and are trying to get to Europe to apply for refugee status. When boats wreck and the people are rescued by Libyan authorities, they're usually then brought to detention centers, where they often suffer human rights abuses and are endangered by the ongoing war in that country. UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration say 7,000 people have been returned to Libya this year, and 17,000 have made it to Italy or Malta. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
International visitors to Australia may be required to have a vaccination against COVID-19 under government plans. Canberra says it has secured the rights to the Oxford University vaccine in the United Kingdom, which is thought to be one of the front runners in the global race to find an effective treatment. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Oxford University study is among a crowded international field of teams racing to develop a safe and effective coronavirus vaccine. Usually, scientific work of this complexity would take years, but research is being fast-tracked at unprecedented speed. Australia has signed a deal with British drug maker AstraZeneca to produce and distribute the Oxford vaccine if it works. All Australians would be offered doses, but a medical panel would determine a priority list of recipients, including health workers and the elderly. Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
We have signed a letter of intent with AstraZeneca, which will enable Australia to access, should it be successful, the vaccine for COVID-19 here in Australia, manufactured here in Australia, distributed free to 25 million Australians in the event that those trials prove successful.
Morrison backtracked after earlier suggesting vaccinations against the coronavirus could become mandatory for Australian citizens. However, government officials have said the vaccine could be compulsory for anyone travelling to Australia if that was the advice from medical experts. Australia's borders are currently closed to foreign nationals. Paul Kelly, the nation's chief medical officer, believes uptake of any vaccine in Australia would be high.
The first will be a voluntary call for people, and I'm sure there will be long queues, socially distanced, of course, for this vaccine. It will be incredibly welcomed by many. It will be the absolute ticket to get back to some sort of normal society and the things that we all love and enjoy.
The aim is for 95% of the population to be inoculated, although experts doubt that figure could be achieved because of concerns in Australia about any new coronavirus drug and the speed at which it's been developed. Australia was also looking to sign deals with other vaccine developers. Human trials on a potential treatment have started at the University of Queensland. Experts there believe a vaccine will be available for emergency use by the middle of 2021. Officials in Canberra have said they were in discussions with Australia's neighbours, including Indonesia, Papua New Guinea and Fiji, about supplying a vaccine. Australia has recorded about 450 coronavirus deaths, most from an outbreak in the state of Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. The man-made mega constellation orbiting Earth grew again this week after another history-making commercial launch. Satellite images document a quarter century of melting ice on Earth, plus images of our home planet from space and of space from our home planet. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us the week in space.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. And liftoff for the Falcon 9. Good Starlink.
From Florida's Cape Canaveral, the commercial spaceflight company SpaceX launched another batch of its Starlink satellites into space. The launch marked the second Starlink mission this month and SpaceX's 14th mission so far this year. Also on board were three Earth observation satellites called SkySats. SpaceX says the Falcon 9 booster that carried the satellites set a record Tuesday, becoming the first rocket to complete 6 flights. The company says its Starlink network will provide high-speed broadband internet to underserved parts of the world. Also this week, scientists in the United States said they analyzed 25 years' worth of satellite data to look deep beneath the surface of Antarctica's melting ice shelves. PhD student Sushil Adesumili studies at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego.
So usually, if you're trying to look at changes in the ocean, you take a ship there. But in Antarctica, because the ocean's under thousands of feet of ice, you have to use satellite data.
Adesumili credits European Space Agency satellites for a quarter century's worth of measurements taken from the ice sheets in Antarctica. Radar altimeter satellites make it possible for researchers to study the data.
What they have is a radar ping, and it's a very short burst of energy. And that goes down from the satellite, which is orbiting around 500 miles above the Earth, hits the ice and comes back up. So what we do is we measure the time that the radar signal takes to hit the ice and come back up.
The faster those pings bounce back to space, the thicker the ice. NASA funded the study, which estimates the continent's ice shelves lost nearly 4,000 gigatons since 1994, producing an amount of meltwater that could almost fill the Grand Canyon. NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy captured these still images of Hurricane Genevieve from the International Space Station. The National Hurricane Center warns Genevieve could cause life-threatening flash floods and mudslides across Southern California. And finally, Russian cosmonaut Ivan Vagner captured this time-lapse of Antarctic aurora or the Southern Lights. Vagner says he also saw 5 objects that, at the time of this report, remain unidentified. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News,
Washington.
And Jay-Z and Pharrell Williams have teamed up to release a new song about Black ambition titled Entrepreneur. The track will be released later today. It's in conjunction with Time's special cover project, The New American Revolution, which was curated by Williams and includes conversations with a number of people about the inequalities Black people encounter in the U.S. Jay-Z is the featured artist on Williams' song. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.